The Best of Our Knowledge explores topics on learning, education, and research. Coming up, birds of a different feather sometimes flock together. We'll learn about two separate species of raptor that have displayed an unusual friendship. And elephants depend on their trunks to navigate the world, and their whiskers make it all possible. I'm Lucas Willard, host of The Best of Our Knowledge. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. You know the saying, birds of a feather flock together. But what about birds of a separate species? For the first segment of our program, I spoke with Lori Boyce, a researcher at St. Mary's University in San Antonio. Lori co-authored a paper that documents her experience in observing two different species of raptor, the black vulture and the crested caracara, sharing a moment on her rooftop. The birds were seen grooming each other's feathers, a behavior that's not exactly common between two birds of separate species.
Now, the first observation actually took place at my personal home. So I had dropped my daughters off at school and I was coming back, and our roof was the highest perch point in the neighborhood just based off of the way the house was constructed as well as the landscape of that area. So it was very common for us to have different types of birds on the roof. But this one was different because it was the crested caracara and the vulture together. So usually we didn't see two raptors up there at the same time. And as I started to watch them, and over the period of, 20, 30 minutes, we started to see that not only did we have the crested caracara and the black vultures together, but the crested caracara actually put their head down and really started to invite the black vulture to come over and start preening them. And then what was also more amazing is that we also got another pair up there. So when you look in the literature, usually we only see one kind of pair together, but in this case, we had two pairs. So I like to do some amateur photography. It's just a kind of a hobby of mine. So I went out there and I started taking pictures of it. And then not long after that, we saw this happening in Phil Hartberger Park, which is a great park that we have in San Antonio. It has one of the largest land bridges in the nation that is associated with it. And my home's only about a mile as the crow flies from that observation in Hartberger Park.
I had to Google a photo of a crested caracara because I live in upstate New York, where right now there's about a foot of snow on the ground, and it's not a bird that I commonly see. But you had mentioned these are both raptor species, that the crested caracara and the black vulture. They seem to have some sort of familiarity in their appearance. I mean, the vulture looks like the vulture. The crested caracara looks a little different, has this black and white plumage. But I guess to a casual observer, it seemed to me in looking at the paper, I guess I wouldn't have even thought twice that one species of bird was preening the feathers of another bird. But is it unusual that two different species would actually interact like this? And does it maybe have anything to do with the resemblance in these two bird species and the fact that they are both raptors?
Yeah, definitely. It's a great question. So it is very unusual for us to see birds of different species preening each other. It is common to see birds of the same species preening each other. There are social implications for that. But birds of different species, we generally do not see that. There have been a few isolated reports of that. Within crested caracara and black vultures, we have seen this and other reports that are dating back as far to at least the 1980s. But the difference with this was going to be in an urban environment where we typically see all the other the interspecific allo preening occurring in rural environments or in forest and things of that nature. Now, you mentioned that this is not a bird you're familiar with. The crested caracara, really, their range is South America, Central America, and a little bit of Texas. And their range is going a little north. I don't see it going all the way to upstate New York, but they do look different in that the crested caracara does have plumage on its head, whereas the black vultures are bald. And so there is some idea that maybe because these birds are in close proximity, they may be in the same sites where maybe there's a carcass. that there could be some sort of relationship here where they're both getting something from this, where the vultures want to make sure that the Karakara maybe don't have lice and mites and other parasites that might be bad for the black vultures. And so maybe there's a relationship there that's happening. Maybe it's just pure friendship. you know, they're kind of an odd to me. They look like an odd couple. you know, the black vultures, nobody really thinks of them as the prettiest bird. They're bald. They kind of maybe, you know, they're not necessarily appreciated for their beauty. Whereas the crested Karakara, like you said, it has that black and white plumage. They have beautiful striking yellow legs. They have a kind of bicolored beak. So they're kind of, like I said, a little bit of an odd couple. We don't know why they're preening each other. But obviously this is something that's happening both in urban and rural environments. And again, like that initial observation where we saw two pairs, so a total of four birds on that roof, kind of like a rooftop party, right? Where we had two Karakara and two black vultures, and the black vultures were both performing the preening on the Karakara. So there has to be something there that's mutualistic between the two to do this.
Sure. And when we think of other symbiotic relationships, we think of the bird that rides on the back of the rhinoceros, right? Or the clownfish and the sea anemone. But we don't usually think of two birds who are really preying on the same food source. In this case, these birds are scavengers, correct? So they're occupying in some ways the same niche, where it's a little less maybe I do one thing, I scratch your back, you scratch mine, because you offer protection from predators and I can clean your appendages or something like that. So it seems a little bit less obvious as to why these birds would be helping each other.
Yeah, absolutely right. And so that's one of the things where we don't fully understand it. The fact that we do have longstanding observations of this in the rural environment makes us think that, yeah, there's definitely something there. So my co-author, Terry Shackelford, her father-in-law is a very prolific birder, and he lives in Uvalde, Texas, which is not far from San Antonio. And he sees these birds together all the time. He said, yeah, I see them together all the time. And so we actually asked him, hey, can you go back and look at all of your records? And we wanted to see if we had any records of him showing allopreening, or specific allopreening between the two. And he wasn't able to find any of the pictures out of, you know, tens of thousands of pictures that he had on hand. And so they are together a lot. They are in those same areas where we have birds essentially scavenging on the same carcass. That is not uncommon. It is somewhat uncommon to see them preening each other. And so it does beg the question of, is there some sort of familiarity between the birds that are preening each other? Because it's not something we see all the time amongst all birds, even when they're in close proximity. But it does kind of beg that question of, is there a familiarity between those birds? Is it a sign of friendship? Now, again, as scientists, we don't really want to put human attributes onto the birds or animals that we're studying, but it does make us start to ask those types of questions. And the other thing is, because the observations that we had at my home, as well as Philharberger Park, they aren't far from each other. It was another interesting question that begs is, were these the same birds that were participating in this activity or not? So, yeah, like you said, it isn't necessarily, it changes the types of questions that we ask, because like you said, it doesn't provide a clear cut question as to, or an answer as to, are they participating in this activity because they're each getting something very specific from each other, or what is that reason? Because they are kind of competing for that same food source, like you said.
And your paper also highlights the importance of urban green spaces as well. If you observed these animals interacting in this friendly sort of way, if I can use the term, but this certainly points to the creating the opportunity just to see these kinds of interactions, because sometimes it may seem like all we need to do is to look up to see some unusual or interesting animal behavior, and obviously having the habitat to observe these birds is all the more important.
Yeah, absolutely. I would agree with that. I mean, I think this isn't necessarily my area of science that I typically study in, but like I said, I'm an amateur photographer. I just like to do it. I'm not doing it to sell the pictures or anything of that nature, but it's a fun thing to do. And I think when you look at science, you really want to make sure that you're being observant. And that's the number one part of being a scientist, is being observant and looking at what's around you and starting to think about how those mechanisms work. The other thing that I would say, like you were mentioning, urban parks provide that opportunity to see these interactions, but we also need citizen scientists. And so we took information from iNaturalist, which is an app that allows you to identify really anything living, whether it's a bug, a plant, a bird, a mammal, anything living. It will tell you what that species is and its scientific name. And then that information goes into a repository that scientists like Terry Shackelford and myself were able to go through and become to look at what is the relative abundance of these raptors in San Antonio as a whole versus looking at just the park. But there's other ones as well. If you were more specifically interested in birds, there's eBird and Merlin. There's a lot of different opportunities out there to be a citizen scientist. So I really encourage individuals to get their boots on the ground and go out there and look to see what's in the skies, what's on your roof.
Lori Boyes is a research assistant professor of biological sciences at St. Mary's University in San Antonio. Her research is published in Ecology and Evolution. This is The Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Lucas Willard. Elephants are blind without their whiskers. The large mammals with poor eyesight are born with about 1,000 whiskers on their trunks to help them navigate their surroundings. And Andrew Schultz, a postdoc at the Max Planck Institute for Intelligent Systems in Stuttgart, says the sensitive whiskers that cover an elephant's trunk have built-in intelligence. The Best of Our Knowledge's Madeline Reynolds spoke with him to learn more.
There's three different types of elephants. So I spent a lot of time during my PhD studying African elephants, which are the largest, and they're these really, really large charismatic animals that can grow to be 12 to 14 feet tall for males, can weigh several tons, and they have so many fascinating characteristics, but the African elephants are much larger than Asian elephants, and Asian elephants are about probably, let's say, like 60 to 70% of the size. And a lot of people identify them by their ears, but there's so many fascinating differences. So like African elephants, one of my favorite like fun facts about elephants in general is I've studied their trunks a lot. And if you look at the tip of an African elephant trunk, they have two fingers on the tip. And then an Asian elephant has a single finger and like a bulb. And this is thought because African elephants are browsers. So they need to like have two fingers to be able to grab things like leaves. And then Asian elephants are more of like grazers. So they are like cows and they're grazing on the ground. But there's so many different things. Elephants have lateralization. So they actually have a left or right handedness preference that is about equal in the animal kingdom. So about 50-50. And you can tell, because we're going to get into talking about their whiskers, but if you look at an elephant's trunk and you look at some of the photos that have been shared in this, you'll see one side of the elephant's trunk has longer whiskers than the other side. And this is actually because as the elephant's kind of going and grabbing objects, one side of their whiskers will get abrased on the ground. And that is their like preferential direction. So if you just look really closely at an elephant, you can actually tell if they prefer left or right-handed grabs based on which whisker side is shorter.
Wow. And I'm glad you talked about trunks, because my next question has to do with that. So I was going to ask, I feel like trunks are a defining physical trait of an elephant. And I, from videos I've seen, they use it a lot. So I was wondering why they use their trunks so much. And, you know, I would love for you to explain why they rely on it as much as they do, it seems.
Yeah. I mean, they use it for so many different types of things. So there's elephants, the trunk is actually the translation for whiskers, right, in a lot of languages is mustaches. And what is, I think, interesting is then when people hear that elephants have whiskers, that it's confusing, but a elephant trunk is actually an extension of the upper lip. So you can kind of think of an elephant, they have this really, really long upper lip that has been basically fused with their nose. So a trunk, they can get, let's say, 2 to 3 meters long. They weigh several hundred pounds, and they're made of pure muscle. So the two structures that are most similar to elephant trunks are actually mammal tongues, so like the tongues in our mouths, or things like octopus tentacles or arms. And they're purely made of muscle, and they take elephants somewhere between baby elephants 1 to 2 years to use them and to learn how to actually successfully use them for so many things. So examples of what they use their trunks for, some fun examples is when elephants are traversing water, a really deep water, they'll actually stick their trunks out and use their trunks as snorkels. They do things called trunk shakes. So when two matriarchs meet, they will basically wrap their trunks around each other and normally smell each other. They have these essentially lobes that secrete hormones, and they will smell these like lobes to get kind of a sense of each other. Eating over 200 kilograms, so like of food every single day, and a lot of this is it's a really, really like unique part of the trunk. And I mean, people have been studying it for literally hundreds of years, and they use it for so much of their daily lives. And I think one of my favorite like memeable things about elephant trunks is if you look up pictures of baby elephants, you will see a lot of times that they have their entire heads dunked into water. So elephants, it's their primary way of transporting water into their mouths for when they're drinking. But babies don't know how to control their trunks well enough to do this. So what they have to do is basically dunk their head in the water to be able to drink. So many parts of their daily lives are spent using their trunk.
So I would like to know how you conducted your study into specifically the whiskers that are on elephants' trunks.
Oh my gosh. So kind of how this as a scientist, like projects like this are kind of like a weird, cheesy thing of where a bunch of puzzle pieces fall into place. So I did my PhD. We were studying on how an elephant trunk moves. And I'm a mechanical engineer, and we were trying to understand when we look at how a trunk moves, if we can look at building inspiring robots that can mimic this type of movement. And as a postdoctoral researcher, I was looking at labs, and my postdoctoral lab, Catherine Kuchenbecker, who is the last author of the study, is an expert on touch. And so when we were brainstorming projects, we were thinking of ways that elephants interact and touch their surroundings. And one of the things that we ended up talking about is that elephant trunks are covered in these whiskers. And I find myself as a very interdisciplinary scientist. And so what we wanted to look at is kind of wipe away any prior assumptions we have about elephants' whiskers and try to characterize these using material science techniques. So we split this into three specific things: the geometry, so really how they're shaped, porosity is how many basically holes, how hollow they are, and the material stiffness. And some of the unique characterization that we did is we characterized these whiskers and how they change from the base to the tip.
So I would love for you to talk a little bit more about the structure of the actual whiskers.
Yeah.
And in the article I was reading, they have a built-in, quote-unquote, intelligence in them.
Yeah.
And I would just love to know how that works in that sense, and if you could give an example of how the elephants use their whiskers out in the wild.
Yeah, so okay, so we'll tackle this one at a time. So when we look at something like an elephant's whisker, right? They what we did is we characterized them using this really cool technique called nano indentation. So we basically actually have this really, really high precision poker that we put inside of a microscope, and we're able to characterize the structure of these. Using this, it's called a pico indenter, so picometer scale. And what we found is that at the base of the elephant trunk, they're filled with these hole-like channels that actually look a lot like horns and hooves. And what these holes at the base actually help the elephant do is when they're contacting objects as they're moving their trunks around, they're able to kind of distribute the energy of those contacts, not just in the outer portions of the whisker, but in the holes. Then these holes kind of fill in as they get to the tip of the trunk. So you can kind of think of you have this base that's really really porous, and it gets to this tip that's really stiff. And then when we use that indenter, what we found is the base is really really stiff. So it's a really it's as stiff as some things like you could think of something like a plastic, and then it transitions to this tip that is very very soft, and it's as soft as rubber. And so you have this porous really stiff base going to this dense very soft tip. And when an elephant is interacting with an object in its daily life, what this change does is as an elephant is contacting an object, they need to figure out how far away that object might be. And when we look at other animal whiskers, things like, let's say, a rat or a mouse, they're able to use muscles at the base of their whiskers to basically move the whiskers in a whisking pattern. Elephants can't whisk. So they don't have this additional ability to kind of contact. And what this stiff to soft and this porous to dense does is it builds in some of the computation or the thinking of where a object might be into kind of the material design of these whiskers. So you can think of if a contact is happening at the very, very tip, or of the whisker, or a contact is happening at the mid or the base. Each of these has a really, really kind of clear vibration pattern that is sent to the mechanoreceptors below. And this is kind of helping kind of offset what mice and rats can do with the whisking motion. And this could be for an elephant identifying objects as they're interacting with their trunk. It could be a looking at if something is a like a ripe leaf or not. And they interact with so many different objects that are stiff versus soft in their daily lives. So elephants have, it's not necessarily bad eyesight, but these whiskers can help them offset some of the items that they might not be able to see. And this is really what rats, cats, mice use their whiskers for, is in some of these blind spots. I think I answered all parts.
Yes, no, that was great. So I'm curious, when do the whiskers develop? Do they develop fast or do they develop slowly?
So they're born with about 1,000 whiskers on their trunk.
Oh,
So
okay.
and one of the things that is very different is, so in rats and mice, they have multiple. So if basically a whisker gets pulled out, then a second whisker or third whisker might kind of grow into place. So you can almost think of animals like when we lose our first set of teeth, right? Another set grow back. Elephant whiskers don't appear to have that. So when you think of whiskers kind of extending from a trunk, an elephant, right, has all of these whiskers that are extending that are providing additional sensory volume with their surroundings. So because they cannot grow back, as these whiskers kind of, if they lose one of these whiskers, they kind of have a blind volume or a blind spot along their trunk. And this is one of the things that this built-in kind of material intelligence does, is through the soft tip, they're able to deform well. And then through this energy absorption of the porous base, they're able to absorb some of those contacts that they're having every day. So they've kind of developed this way where their whiskers are not going to fail as easily as something like a rat or a mouse's whisker might.
So something that I found really cool in the article when I was reading is that you created a replica, like a bigger replica of an elephant whisker. There it is. And I was wondering what that experience was like and what you learned from creating this replica.
One of the things that has been really cool is the group that I'm a part of, the department that I'm a part of, it's called the Haptic Intelligence Department. And when people think of haptics, they often think of like touch. And something that we do not use as a sense very often when it comes to scientific exploration is the idea of touch. So we were really, Catherine and I were really stumped of trying to understand some of the benefits of why a whisker might transition from the stiff base to a soft tip. And what happened is we have some of these whisker wands, which transition from a stiff base to a soft tip. And what it realized, as the team of researchers, we realized was that as you make contacts along this whisker wand, if you compare it to something that is a complete, the same material, when you have these gradients of a stiff base to a soft tip, each of the points along the whisker feels completely different. And it was able to kind of give us insight of developing a mathematical model to test this hypothesis, which we found verified. And I think the part that is really interesting is when we think of, I just think of being like a kid and like being in the playground or kind of we touch so much of our surroundings, but in science we have not been able to touch a lot of our surroundings in general. And so when we found some of these insights, right, it's kind of interesting because then if you actually pick up a whisker yourself and you actually feel along the whisker's length, so if your cat has a whisker that falls off, you can feel some of these same kind of insights that we found through using touch as a scientific exploration tool. And so I think what's been really exciting about it is in a department that is focused on haptics, we're also trying to look at ways where we can use our own haptics to understand the world around us, including something as special as like an elephant's whisker, but also just, I think it's a underutilized tool in scientific exploration.
That was Andrew Schultz, a researcher at the Max Planck Institute for Intelligent Systems. His research is published in the journal Science. He spoke with the best of our knowledge's Madeline Reynolds. This has been The Best of Our Knowledge, episode 1846. The Best of Our Knowledge is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio. The latest on all national productions programs is available via the Airwaves newsletter and our flagship station's website, WAMC.org. Until next time, I'm Lucas Willard.